rational world can solve the inside problem by outside means. The Pietists and many other mystical groups, following in the example of the ancient mystery system, came to the conclusion that each individual must cross the bridge between his own personality and the divine archetype that lies within him. Man is a manifold creature, of which only a small part is visible. The invisible part of man is much more splendid, much vaster in its potentials, more reliable in its testimonies, more inevitable in its ends. Therefore, this little part, this small end of a composite creature, which we call the human being and the human body, this is forever existing within a mysterious age of energies, of mysterious spiritual invisible powers, moving, turning, constantly impelling, and constantly nourishing. Part of the invisible does nourish the body. Part of the invisible does nourish the mind and the emotions. But that part which nourishes these things is moved by an eternal principle of truth. And therefore, the soul in itself is apart from its manifestations, but may not be recognized by us except through the projections of its own elements into the material constitutions of life. We are therefore living truly, wonderfully within our own spiritual life. We are surrounded and ensouled by a power which in Pilgrim's Progress is referred to as the armor of righteousness. This is in truth our eternal defense. It is the inside that must save the outside. And it is also the outside that must be brought into union with the internal before we can plan an enduring civilization. To find this other part is difficult now because we are completely controlled by luxury and appetite. Our idea of happiness is abundance, not abundance of virtue, but abundance of worldly possessions or opportunities to do as we please. In this wonderful pattern of things, in which we, if we could only see all of ourselves, the spiritual as well as the material parts, we would be in awe. We would fall on our knees because we would be standing in the presence of that blazing bush which Moses saw. We would see God moving through the tremendous involvement of our structure, more wonderful, more beautiful, more strange to us than even the galaxies we are seeking to explore. And yet to find this, to be really achieve this recognition, we must change patterns which prevent the possibility of the true discovery of life. We must realize, as we sit back quietly and nurse alcoholism, or become narcotics addicts, or live on barbiturates, that these things are not the way of life. We must realize that extravagance leading to intemperance is the way of gradual disintegration. Now it is true that that which lies behind this form will not disintegrate. It will be like a mysterious parent that has a wayward child. This inner parent principle, the soul, can look out and mourn over the delinquencies of the body, which refuses to be aware of its presence. And as many a mother or father today are concerned over the intemperances of their children, and yet are powerless to change them. So the soul in man is represented in ancient art as a weeping woman, weeping over the sin of the world. This soul power is, however, eternal, inevitable. If by our own carelessness, our own destructiveness, we cast aside the works of this world, if we decrease the energies of our bodies, if we misuse the faculties of our minds, and if we abuse the mysteries of our emotions, we sicken. And we may very probably pass out of this life without ever having achieved the purpose for which we were born. Man was born not to die. He was not created merely to go through a short span of years and then vanish forever. Man was born to grow, and growth is unfoldment. It is ideation from within ourselves. We were born into this world to become better. And to the degree that we fail to accept the challenge of being better, we frustrate the purpose of our own existence. Under such conditions, if we have become so set in our ways that it is impossible for us to forgive our enemies, overcome our grievances, or master our appetites, nature in its infinite wisdom brings this material body to an end. We are actually released from conditions we cannot change because of habit. And what we call death is simply the individual shuffling off for a little while, not just the body, but all the habits, attitudes, and policies which have denied the soul its proper manifestation in daily life. But if we can begin to develop the resources that are proper, we will find that the enlightened soul, blazing forth in its glory from within the depths of ourselves, is a kind of star of Bethlehem. It announces the coming of salvation. It announces that the individual is growing to the point where the inner good can become manifest in the outer life. Now, many people have tried, each in his own way, to accomplish some type of release of this inner good. For centuries, ascetics have denied themselves most of the material advantages of living in order to separate their consciousness from bondage to material things. Others have sought in various ways to express their inner convictions through art, through music, through all of the creative expressions, for all of the arts belong to the soul, just as surely as the skills belong to the mind. Art has always been a kind of symbolic instrument of release. It has given us pictures of things unseen. It has given us lessons in moral and character. It has made more beautiful our homes. Beautiful paintings have become windows on walls. Beautiful music brings us closer to the chanting of the cherubim. But all these things have also been reduced. Arts have been profaned. All these skills have been utterly commercialized. As a result, they gradually deteriorate in principle and in spirit. We have lost the validity of our art in many instances because of our own interpretation of the purpose of beauty. We have thought of it as a commodity, when in reality it is a great necessity. To look forward then into the things that are likely to happen in the appreciable future, we see a world that is in the throes of a mystical rebirth. We see the rise of a new asceticism. We behold the individual, first of all, turning against what he calls the establishment. Now, the establishment is simply a term. There is a little story about a schoolboy who came home with long hair. The parents didn't like it very well and asked him why he did it. And he said, because that is a way of badging a determination to resist the establishment. It is a proof I'm against the establishment. Well, the parent said, can't you prove it some other way? He said, certainly not, because if I don't do it this way, our establishment will not be able to go on. So he belonged to an establishment built upon long hair. As a rebellion against an establishment built upon long dollars. The problem just shifts its position, but is not solved. But against the establishment of corruption, we find not really a rebellion against civilization or society, but a rebellion against a restriction upon our right to grow, a situation that makes growth almost impossible for the average young person starting out today. He will face problems that the older generation has never known. He finds the world around him an enemy to that which he might dream of accomplishing if he had the opportunity. He does not want to sink back into the material slough of despond which is binding his ancestors. But actually, what we are saying is that there is gradually arising among us, not really a revolt against establishment, but a revolt against the fact that establishment as we know it is materialistic, atheistic, or agnostic at best. We are not any longer able to stand the pressure of mistakes. They are closing in upon us, threatening our civilization, and threatening the possibility of these young people growing up to establish firm and solid homes and raise families in their turn. Our way of life has got to grow, because at the moment the crisis is partly due to the fact that we are outgrowing the way of life that we've been clinging to. We have become aware that what we are doing is not correct, that our ambitions and aspirations are not all legitimate, that we are in constant need of building a world around us that will represent the world within us. And to do this, we must gradually restore what the ancients called the Golden Age as our first line of defense against the Age of Gold. This realization means that we are growing. It is a good sign. There will be mistakes. Many of these young people will get into desperate troubles because they have no guidances. They have no foundations upon which to build. But one thing is evident. Many of these younger people are desirous of a better way of life than they have ever known. Being in inexperience, having little, if anything, to guide them, they are making very many mistakes. They are getting into serious difficulties, not because they want to, but because to them the resistance program is simply against conditions rather than being a challenge to the unfoldment of internal resources. Not long ago, the Chinese under Mao made what was called the Great Cultural Revolution. This revolution was called by Mao the Great Leap into the Future. It was a disaster. And as we find from our press today, China is gradually trying to recover from the Great Leap into the Future. Why? Because that Great Leap had as its fundamental principle absolute materialism. It was to be a leap into industrial success, a leap into wealth, power, world control. It was a leap into a condition in which the rules of Karl Marx were to take the place of the laws of Confucius. But it was a disaster. Mao should have consulted the I Ching and not Das Kapital. He was not able to solidify and unify. He did a great deal of good. He would have done much more if he had not attempted to destroy the way of his own people. Now it is being restored. The profits of China are coming back into estimation, because there is no remedy for world conditions except the restoration of religiously oriented idealism. Even Napoleon, who was not what might be termed especially devout, said that there is no nation can be ruled without religion. No nation can be governed without religion. No nation can grow without religion. This must be the link, the only link that we generally recognize between the material and the spiritual. It is the one power which causes us or strengthens us to suffer for principles. It is the only power that we know that can cause us to renounce temporal advantages in order to achieve the salvation of the species. So we have this realization that coming up today, our young people who, when experience strengthens and deepens their lives, may accomplish what we have failed to accomplish, namely the restoration of an internal life, the recognition that we must have faith in the infinite or the finite will fail. So it is with each of us now, regardless of our years. In the terms of the universe, we may all be considered very, very old, and we can also be considered merely emerging from infancy. It depends upon the perspective. One thing is certain, we all need a lot more growth. We all need a lot more insight into the realities and purposes of our own existence. The rising tide of religion will increase. There is no doubt in the world that every day of emergency is causing many people to think for the first time in their lives. And their thoughts will not be entirely upon the society around them, because there is nothing to be found there that solves anything for them. This thoughtfulness will turn gradually to the correction of causes. It will point out the endless tragedy of discords. It will tell us that no matter who wins the revolution, there will be another revolution. The only answer for the thoughtful person is to find solution. And he can only find solution by discovering the fact of the necessity of obeying the universal archetype. We must live as we were intended to live or suffer. Millions of people are coming to this conclusion. More will as time goes on. Each of us will have to come in fullness of time to the realization that we are here to obey and flourish under a great dispensation of benevolence. We are here because of the endless benevolence of deity. We are here because the creating power, in its own inevitable manner, determined the salvation of all that lives, and then prepared the mechanism which made this salvation inevitable. This inevitability of the way of salvation is a disappointment to a great many people who really do not want to be saved. They would prefer to follow the materialistic point of view that when they're dead, they're very dead, and that's the end of it. Materialism, therefore, not only is inadequate, but it gives the individual a non-valid excuse for remaining as he is. It remains for him, therefore, to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow he is dead. But what we realize is that when we eat, drink, and be merry, we only get rid of the body, but we are still alive to face the consequences of our own actions. Most people are not oriented to this concept, however. Having come to a realization that we are here to survive, we then can approach the whole problem of life with a greater optimism. We are becoming a world of neurotics, frightened, disappointed, and disillusioned. But what we are really being disillusioned in is our own mistakes. We are existing in the proof and consequences that we didn't do it right. Now, this is an important discovery. because it can lead us to realize that we must find out what is right and stay with it. This is all part, therefore, of cosmic growing pains. We are like children who, coming up through adolescence, develop all kinds of ailments, from acne to neurotics. While they are trying to work with this body, they suffer from the measles, the mumps, and all kinds of ailments. They also suffer from the awkwardness of their own unadjusted psychological structure. They are in the process of gradually growing up. At any point along the way, it might be a disappointing situation. There are many children that do not look as though they will ever grow up, but most of them do. And the problem child of today is the good citizen of tomorrow. The problem humanity of today is the cooperative commonwealth of tomorrow. We are simply growing. And growing is not a source for discontent or despair. If we were able to continue in our mistakes forever, then there would be cause for despair. If the problems that face us now were going to be our problems till the end of eternity, who would want to live? Actually, however, change comes in. And in nature, when men disobey and get punished for their disobediences, the change is gradually but inevitably for the better. We are slow of learning, however. We cling desperately to the attitudes that we have long held and simply refuse, if we can avoid the challenge, to change our ways. Therefore, instead of worrying about this problem, instead of getting all unhappy about the terrors of the times, let us realize that they are part of a plan in which there is neither death nor destruction. As the Bhagavad Gita so beautifully points out, the great war of the world is not the end. The great war of the world is a constant testing by which we divide weakness from strength and gradually strengthen that which is weak. There is no death, but only a change of worlds. There is no end of anything but ultimate perfection. And it is that ultimate perfection which we want to cooperate with in every way possible. We want to do our share in leading the world from its immaturity to a condition of true integration, true security, true maturity. If we will change our point of view, we can do it a little bit or help ourselves by two concepts which may be useful to us. The first is faith. Without faith, works are impossible. Without faith, nothing can grow. Without faith, we are constantly living in an insecurity. Faith tells us that there is hope. Faith tells us there is purpose. Faith tells us that all of our weaknesses will ultimately be brought into enlightenment. Faith tells us there is a reason for what is happening to us, that reason is good, and that if our faith is great enough, we can face the emergency without fear or despair. Therefore, faith is probably one of the strongest forces in our lives today. The second great power that we need to understand these principles is the willingness to accept. We must find in faith the strength necessary for the acceptance of things as they are. Faith must show us that we must suffer things to be so now because we have caused them. Faith coming along with the recognition of the need and the desperate purpose of the plan in which we live makes a great difference in our point of view. Faith creates acceptance. Acceptance, studied and meditated upon by the mind and the heart, strengthens faith. The redemption of the world begins with a single step. The first step the individual takes in trying to grow must be taken on faith alone. He steps into an unknown world of causes, leaving behind him a smug little world of contentions and discords. The first step toward reality must be inspired by faith. It must be strengthened and skilled by the acceptances of those situations which are necessary to growth. If then we start in with faith and we are willing to assume that what is happening is the greater good, that out of all emergencies come greatness and wonder. Out of the dark earth comes the flower. Out of the mistakes we have made comes the fulfillment of our destiny. Therefore, we must have this faith stronger than fretting, fearing, and doubting. We must try to look out upon life and become aware of the good that is there. To be able to estimate that which is real is more important than to fall under the hypnosis of that which is unreal. Everywhere, if we look with faith, we will find grounds for faith. If we look with fear, we will find grounds for fear. If we look and study with acceptances, we will find that these things accept things of value. If we do not accept and reject that which is next, we lock ourselves further into our own disaster. So people who are wandering around now, trying to find a place to go where they'll survive an earthquake, worried to death about their stocks and bonds, miserable over the conflict in their families, and overly concerned with the conflicts of nations, these persons must recognize that their foundation that is enduring will be that to see through all of these disasters a purpose that must be fulfilled, a purpose that must be met, and that actually to have our attention focused upon these needs is the greatest good that can happen to us, much more valuable than sitting quietly and watching some impossible television performance. We can accept what we do not like. Discipline. The discipline of the infinite over the finite. The defense of principles, which is forever interfering with our pleasures and our luxuries. But if we can really begin to see the plan, fear will go. There is nothing to be afraid of in this world. The only things that we should be regretting are the things we do badly. We have sometimes good cause for regret, but no cause for terror. We may feel the insecurity of our material situation means the end of us, but in reality, it means the beginning of us. When we never know of truly how much we are worth until we lose most of what we have. Then we measure the person by what he is, and he never was to be measured by any other rule. Any other estimation of him is fallacy. The individual is what he is and must be measured on that, and not by his worldly goods, his public office, or his private influence. So when we begin to think in this way, we don't have to be so worried anymore. We will be where we ought to be. We will come when we are supposed to and go when we're supposed to. Not because of fatal necessity. Not because there is some despotism that is controlling these things. But rather that in the path of growth, we come and go as growth requires. And after all, the end is the important thing. Ultimately, we must live with ourselves in the great eternity which we call life. And to prepare for this is far more important than any other task we can undertake. So let's think in terms now of not worrying, not fearing. We may have the deepest sympathy for affliction. We may have the deepest realization that conditions are not right. We may regret all of the fallacies and falsenesses which are surrounding us. But we must also realize that they are part of a divine handwriting on the wall, that they are telling us what we must learn. And because we have not been very good students, we are forced to learn the hard way. That is what it really amounts to. But learn we will. There is no way in which the human being can ultimately escape his own perfection. He wishes it was closer, and he would like it to bring more worldly opportunities. This cannot be guaranteed. But it will be the purpose for which he was fashioned in the beginning, the reason why the spark of his own soul was cast off of the wheels of space. It was created for a destiny, and its destiny must be as great as the power that fashioned it. We therefore do not need to be insecure. All we need to do is to make every possible effort to rectify our own conduct, to live in the light of inner understanding, to share it with those who wish it, to set the example of what is best by living it ourselves, and then with a gentle, quiet faith, accept what heaven bestows. This was the beginning of Chinese philosophy. Heaven bestows, man receives. Therefore, the superior governs the inferior to the end. The superior is infinite good. Therefore, evil cannot prevail. In the next few years, we may have some difficult times. We may find reverses that will hurt us. But we will also probably find that out of the common problem will come the recognition of the common need. I remember not too long ago being involved in a problem involving a local disaster. A number of families that had previously lived together were subject to what appeared to be an act of providence. Their homes were destroyed, their lives were threatened, some passed on. It was a very serious episode. But within 24 hours, humanity moved in. People they had never spoken to came with help. Those who were near and distant were solicitous. They opened their homes to the homeless. They fed the hungry. Not because of law, but because it was their own natural human instinct. And whenever disaster strikes, the human instinct is to help. When a world disaster becomes sufficiently acute, the world instinct will be to solve and to help. And those who had never known each other in prosperity became friends for life as a result of adversity. This is only a symbol, but it points to something. It points to the fact that in our troubles we come together. And the ultimate purpose of life is that we shall come together. In our prosperities, we go our own way. We do not know those close to us. But when trouble comes, humanity rallies to it. And from all over the world, help comes when need arises. This is the situation when the world's problem reaches the condition in which it touches us in the heart instead of in the pocketbook. We will begin to see differently. And out of the misfortunes and tragedies of the moment comes the union of all that lives in one great fraternity of cooperation. We must find that it is necessary. We must also realize that through helping those in need, serving those in trouble, bringing peace to those in pain, we suddenly find a new relationship. A relationship that is not of blood, perhaps not even of a previous friendship, but a relationship of man's natural desire, inevitable soul-seeking within himself, to bring help to those in need. The world is in need today. And as this need grows greater, human beings will more and more forget their own little selfishness and unite to ease the pains of the world. Thus, the will of heaven is fulfilled upon earth. Thus, the eternal shows its victory over the temporal. And thus, the soul, which is forever solicitous, gains dominion over the mind, which is so often self-centered. So in these changes that come, be of good cheer. Do not become fearful. Remember that the promise of the Messianic dispensation remains, that we were created to be eternally enlightened, and that there has descended into us, in this symbolic meaning, the great soul of life, the only begotten of the Father, and that this soul moving within us is the secret of our salvation, and that nothing can prevent that soul from its ultimate victory over the self-centeredness of the human being. We can help to make that victory a little quicker. We can help to bring more of that soul out of ourselves through our conduct, our dedications, and our human instincts. It will come, and when that time does come, we will then have the celebration of the sunrise of a new world, a new age, a new way of life, a way of life in which we live in rather simple relationship with each other, not in material luxuries, but not in poverty, not in having all we want, but wanting only that which is best. Each of us, regardless of the day, this day, any other day, all days, can go on fully convinced and perfectly secure in the realization that that which is our own will come to us, and the soul within us, in its victory over the ignorance or perversity of the outer world, can bring us in the end to that which is promised, that those who believe in reality, believe in truth, believe in the power of salvation from within ourselves, though they pass through great tragedy, will come to the great realization, the great fulfillment, and will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. This type of thinking is, I think, appropriate. So do not continue to fear. Have a natural faith in the law. Have love and fraternity for each other in all of your problems. And accept in the spirit of childhood, accepting the wisdom of a great parent, the lessons of life with peace, understanding, and not only respect, but admiration. If we can achieve this type of thinking, we can meet the future without fear. Well, friends, that's the morning. I'd like to make a couple of announcements at this point.